Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Hugh Warwick. He's an ecologist and environmental writer with a particular fondness for hedgehogs. And we're talking about his new book, Cull of the Wild, Killing in the Name of Conservation. Hugh, welcome to the show. It's such a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thank you so much, Mark. Thank you for inviting me.
Every year, as you write in the beginning of this book, millions of animals are killed in the name of conservation. And I know personally of stories, both from organizations and both from people. People who do things like, okay, I'm going to kill this house wren because it's nesting in a tree swallow box. And I had problems with it from the get-go. This is the first book that I have read that has dealt with the philosophy and the practical aspects of, and the moral issues around this. What pushed you to write this book?
For me, it starts with hedgehogs. I mean, so much of my life.
Everything
with
you starts with hedgehogs.
it's my social media handle is at Hedgehog Hugh. So yeah, but when I was 19, I was doing my research project for my degree in England, and I travelled up to a small island north of Scotland called North Ronaldsay, the most northerly of the islands of the Orkneys, and there they were concerned that the imported hedgehogs were having an impact on the ground nesting birds. And so I spent my summer holidays counting hedgehogs. I went back up there in 1991 and repeated the study, looked at the impact that the hedgehogs were having after a few hundred had been removed from the island. And this was the beginning of my interest in both hedgehogs, but also in the world of wildlife management and these conservation issues, which require subtlety and thought rather than just running in with a sledgehammer. Then in the year 2003, the RSPB, our biggest conservation organization in the United Kingdom, they started killing hedgehogs in the Outer Hebridean Islands of the Uists. And I got involved with that initially as a journalist, but found they were then rather misusing some of my research and joined the campaign to stop the cull. I did research which ended up managing to get the cull stopped, and now they're no longer killing hedgehogs. But this whole set of stories was like, this is fascinating, I'm really interested. But the crux of it came when I met a conservationist from New Zealand who was telling me how they were killing hedgehogs. Now, New Zealand didn't have hedgehogs until the 1860s, when the colonists who were over there wrote back to England and said, this place is gorgeous, but you know what we're missing?
Oh, God.
We're missing hedgehogs. And so hedgehogs are sent out to New Zealand, but for a long time were considered to be the most benign of the introductions. But now it's recognized they're not. Anyway, this conservationist is explaining how they were killing hedgehogs in New Zealand. And I was like, well, you don't need to do that. I've just done research which shows you. And he sat me down and we went through it. And it was very simple. I can see no alternative to killing hedgehogs in New Zealand. Now, I love hedgehogs. I've written 3 books about hedgehogs. I have a hedgehog tattoo. The office from which I speak is filled with hedgehog images, hedgehog paraphernalia. I adore hedgehogs. But I also cannot see a way around this problem. And that's what got the book started for me, was this absolute confrontation between my heart loving hedgehogs and my head being presented with this really, really knotty problem.
And the thrust of the book is you want to start an honest conversation about culling. And you want it to be honest, but that means you're going to have to confront your own prejudices. This is in your own words. And you want to poke your nose outside the bubble. That's because what happens in so many of these cases that are in this book, it's never simple. Everybody thinks the solutions to these problems are simple, but they're complex, and there's a lot of gray area. And so you in this book listen to a lot of different voices, which was amazing, including game keepers, which is something that you never would have before. But you had to really think about how you thought about animals. You write about that. Peter Singer's book, Animal Liberation, was one of the key books in your youth. And you had to think about, what are we doing? Are we killing them, these animals? in the most benign way, and that often is not the case. It's often the most, you know, the whatever's cheapest. But this is a difficult, a complex, difficult book, although you're upbeat throughout the entire damn book. But it's a complex book.
I find the whole subject deeply complex. However, as you say, a degree of upbeat is necessary, partly because, Peter Singer's book, I read it in my youth, but I read the words in my youth. I don't think I really fully understood things. It's only as I've become older and I have read and spent time in the company of philosophers and other thinkers that I've begun to realize how stupid I was back then. You know, this thing is much more complex than I could cope with at age 16. The nuance of it, though, is absolutely crucial as long as you can do it honestly, as I say, at the beginning of the book. And in fact, the very first word of the first draft of this book was prejudice. I was going to begin the book with that word and just outline my prejudices. I am an animal lover. The thought of people killing animals for pleasure makes me feel physically sick.
Me too.
I don't understand these things. I haven't eaten meat for nearly 40 years. I did 10 years very strict vegan, but unfortunately got confounded by very, very good cakes from some of the people I give talks to. It's this level. So whenever I went to meet people whose job it was to kill things, who actually got pleasure from killing things,
ooh,
I was very clear. I find this really difficult. I don't understand it. And I think that really helped because they knew I wasn't going in there trying to trick them. In fact, what was very important to me was everybody in the book got to see precisely what I wrote about them. They got to see their chapters because I didn't want anybody to feel that I was in any way being underhand. Because this whole topic requires transparency and honesty. And you talk about the bubbles, you mentioned the bubbles I talked about. And I realized that it was an idea I hadn't developed. But actually, the edge of the bubbles, they create a lens, and that lens distorts the image that you see. What you'll find is when you drop yourself into somebody else's bubble, or you meet in between them, that actually you share so much more than you think you ever possibly could. And it's at that moment that proper conversations can have. And there's a quote from Joubert from the 18th century. He's saying, the point of argument is not to win, but to make progress. That, for me, was right at the heart of this. I don't need to score points off people. I actually want to understand, and I want to understand how we can do things better.
There's a quote you use in the book, George Bernard Shaw. If you're going to tell people the truth, you better make them laugh, otherwise they'll kill you. And I think that's the underlining thrust of this book. There is a lot of truth there, but you do it in such a way. It's entertaining. A lot of it, I was also amazed, this is a deeply philosophical book, and you start out talking about the trolley problem in philosophy. And yes, you should go over what that is in case people have not heard that.
Oh, the trolley problem is fascinating. And again, it was actually pointed out to me by a friend who is a philosopher. I should say, again, I will reiterate this, I am not a philosopher. I am very much, I've done philosophy 101, that's as far as I've got. But the trolley problem, in the UK, in the United Kingdom, we call them trams. The story basically is you have got a runaway tram coming down a track, and there are five people tied down to the track, and they're going to be killed by the runaway tram. But there is a lever which you can pull, and if you pull that lever, it will take the tram onto a spur on which one person is tied down. And that person will be killed, but those five will be saved. And that is the point. Do you act? Do you act and deliberately kill the one person? Or do you not act at all and allow five people to be killed? And it's the starting point of a whole sequence of thought experiments, which become increasingly impossible to answer simply, but are very useful at giving yourself that realization that these are the sorts of questions we're making. We're making a choice from a conservation point of view as to, okay, so we're actively going to kill these mice, these rats, whatever, to prevent the death of those birds. And it's I think it's the issue is a lot of the time these decisions are taken without that level of thought, without that level of scrutiny. It's not even considered an issue, the killing of the other species.
No, as a matter of fact, many times it's the forces that be will just say, well, it's obvious. They're endangered.
Yeah, absolutely.
They deserve to live.
And we need, and I said one of the points I sort of keep going on about in the book is these have to be conscious decisions. And
right,
not only,
right.
You know, but it has to be a conscious decision. If you choose not to kill, and I have many friends in the animal rights world with whom I disagree an awful lot as well at times, but having to explain to them that if you choose not to act, if you choose not to kill the mice on that island or the rats on that island or the American mink in our countryside, which are causing havoc, that doesn't mean there won't be death. And in fact, in many instances, there may end up being, over time, far more death caused by the active choice not to act.
Right,
and it has to be
right.
That. It's like when you choose not to act, it isn't just like, oh, we don't need to do anything. You're actively choosing that. And it's why when my publishers produced a little postcard, which was sort of throw out the question, you know, should we just let nature take its course? And I'm just like, no. The reason that question is so important is because in each of these instances, the reason why the potential need to act is there is because we've already acted. We've already done this thing.
We are the trolley.
We are the trolley. Yeah, and do we have the capacity to change the direction of that trolley? At no point is there a case where you go, we know the answer straight away, because it's not simple. There are going to be complexities.
And the complexities that come out in the cases that you write about in the book are amazing. Let's start with the hedgehogs and the Uists on the Outer Hebrides?
Yep, yep,
their main predation ends up being wader eggs.
Yep.
And the waders that breed on the Outer Hebrides is some of the largest populations in Britain. So the choice...
They're internationally important, yeah.
So the choice was, well, we could just trap them and slaughter them, or they can be relocated. Now, even when they were being relocated, there were animal rights people who were complaining about the hedgehogs being relocated, saying that they were just going to starve.
The interesting situation that happened there is the reason that the conservationists in the first instance argued that they needed to kill the hedgehogs was because they believed that if you moved the hedgehogs, they would suffer a slow and lingering death, was the phrase that they used. And that was a misrepresentation of some of the data I had collected with some of my other hedgehog research. I was radio tracking hedgehogs which had been released into the wild, and 5 of the 12 died.
Wow.
But not one of those 5 died a slow and lingering death. They all died fast and violent deaths. 3 were eaten by badgers and 2 were run over by cars. And these were things that happened to the wild hedgehogs too. So it was inappropriate to apply that to the case of the Hebridean hedgehogs. It wasn't animal rights activists. It was the conservationists themselves who were saying, we can't move them alive because they'll just die. And the evidence for that was non-existent, and I did research which proved that case. They just misunderstood.
There's a level of complexity here that goes beyond just whether we're going to kill or not. If you're going to kill, how are you killing? Are mm-hmm. the methods that you're using going to be swift and as kind as possible? In the case of hedgehogs, I remember there were spring traps, I think, that ended up not killing the hedgehogs right off because of the hedgehog's physical structure. They would just...
Oh, well, that's interesting. Is in New Zealand, they were using spring traps. They'd never used the spring traps in the UK. In New Zealand, the spring traps initially, yes, hedgehog spines are fantastic shock absorbers. And so these traps, which they thought would be strong enough, simply weren't. They simply went and made the traps stronger.
Now, there's another phrase that you use throughout the book. You feel that the study of ecology should be approached with considerable seriousness. And
absolutely.
And you does that mean you feel that it's not right now?
Oh, absolutely. If you go into any of the cabinet rooms of the governments of the world, you will find vast majority of people in there are studied deeply in politics and economics. And you can probably count the number of ecologists in, I don't know, the G7 governments and cabinet rooms on one hand. I mean, you know, you don't get ecologists at the top table. Yet the very foundations of life on Earth depend on a healthy ecosystem. Everything else, the economy, education, health, all of these things are subsets of a healthy ecosystem. It is unfortunate that the economists got hold of the world and have done very well for themselves out of it. We need ecologists at every top table because these problems need that degree of thought. There is a when you people go to Oxford University and they study PPE, and it's philosophy, politics, and economics. And I was saying people should suffer PPE. They should study, PPE. But it should be philosophy, psychology, and ecology, because I think we would have a much happier and more sustainable world if they did that.
Now, let's take another case from your book. And you start locally, and you really expand it to places like New Zealand and Australia. Let's talk about the squirrels, the gray squirrel of North America and the native, for you, red squirrel, not our red squirrel, but the British red squirrel. This is a case where, and you write about the history of this, and this is how so many of these problems start. Some yodel decides, you know, having gray squirrels from America would be a great thing. And they bring over gray squirrels. In this case, it happened several times. And of course, they get loose. And of course, they start breeding. Now, they're a larger, stronger, more aggressive animal than the really sort of extremely cute, even I admit it, red squirrel that's British with the little tufts on top of the head. And now they're wiping them out. The only sustainable, like large populations of red squirrels right now is in Scotland. But you talk to people like Craig Shuttleworth. I think he's on Anglesey. And he's making an effort to eliminate the gray squirrels and reintroduce the red squirrels. And he's doing it in a very contained geographical location. But people published his address and also, and he's been under threats.
Yes, absolutely. It's a fascinating story, this, because what Craig was trying to do, I should also add, it's not just down to the sort of relative burly nature of the gray squirrel. Out competing the red squirrel, the gray squirrels bring with them a virus, squirrel pox virus, which they are essentially immune to, but the red squirrels are not, and the red squirrels end up dying really horribly. That's actually the reason why there's been such a staggering disappearance of the reds. It was actually animal rights activists who targeted Craig for the work he was doing, even though I would say he was being one of the most sensitive and deliberate of all of the people I met, because he was catching gray squirrels in traps alive so that every animal could be looked at first to check whether it was the right species, so you didn't get bycatch. And the animals, and he would check the traps very regularly. I mean, I met him, we spent time together, he really was conscientious. And the animals would be let into a small sack, and then they would be hit over the head with a small truncheon, and they would be killed instantly. So it was a very quick way of killing them. And the animal rights activists who targeted him were targeting him because he was actively killing the gray squirrels. But the gray squirrels were killing the red squirrels, and so if their actions were to be carried forward and no killing was to take place on the part of Craig, that would mean that the red squirrels would die, but they would feel it wasn't their responsibility because they were at a remove from it. And I think it was just really significant for me because my heart is, don't kill things. I don't want things to be killed. But I can see no alternative with an island like Anglesey. I should just add, however, what Craig Shuttleworth introduced me to was the idea of eradication rather than control. Because I suggested that his little island is off the northwest coast of Wales. And I said, well, why don't you start killing the gray squirrels on the main body of Wales and start? And he said, what's the point? Because all you're doing there is harvesting gray squirrels.
That's right.
They're going to breed and they're going to come back. Why? So he was only justified, he felt, to do this in an area where you can eradicate, and then that's it, because otherwise you're doing it forever. And we've talked about the barred owl, spotted owl conundrum in the United States of America. The solution, and I use that word advisedly, being presented, is one of control, which will go on forever.
Well, that's right. I mean, even in locations like you write about the tiny island of Lundy, which has an amazing history, which is in the book, and the puffins and rats. There's a single person who usually is inspiring and is hiring other people to maintain the, culling on the rats as they show up. Now they've gotten rid of them. But the problem is, unless you have a definite goal and an end point, as you just said, you're just killing into infinity. You're going to always
Absolutely.
Be killing.
Yeah. And so, and not only is it enormously expensive economically, not only does it result in lots of death, but it's also very expensive, very costly in terms of social capital.
Yeah.
Because what are you present when you're next, when you've next got a problem, which you take to the public and say, we need to solve this problem. And they see that the last problem you went to solve is still being paid for. 10 years on, 20
right.
years on down
right.
the line, you stop at any one point, the problem reappears because that's what nature does. They will fill that vacuum. And so unless you can actually get to a point where you eradicated the problem. Now, in terms of the squirrels, going back to the gray squirrels versus the red squirrels, that solution could come with a vaccine for squirrel pox virus.
Right.
So that could be the solution, or it could come with, and work is being done now, with contraception, which is delivered just to gray squirrels, not to red squirrels. They've managed to work out a delivery mechanism. They just haven't actually managed to work out the contraception yet. But that then might be a way of controlling the numbers of gray squirrels without killing them. So if there is time, if there is money put into these problems, more creative solutions can occur. And that's something which I really hope will happen. One of the reasons for writing this book is to sort of lift this murkier side of conservation up into the light for people to go, wait a minute, maybe it's worth investing time and money in more creative solutions, because then maybe we can do this sort of thing with less killing, which would be great.
Another side discussion you have in the book, and I totally agree, is the effect of internet culture. And mm-hmm. that just, it seems to encourage extreme outrage. So you get usually two sides of an issue, and people are just yelling at each other.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is, I mean, I've just had a sort of mini experiment. Some environmental protesters in the United Kingdom have just been put in prison for between 5 and 4 years.
Whoa.
They were arrested on the basis of a Zoom call where they were discussing a protest which would be disruptive. And the idea of giving people who were plotting a nonviolent protest 4 years, anyway, that's quite shocking.
Yeah.
I tweeted about this, and what I found was the amount of anger which came at me from people who didn't believe that climate change existed, that side of things. It was so swift and it was so huge. I mean, it's like over 500,000 impressions to the to the tweet within a day or so. And you just see how quickly this thing, I could have spent my time shouting back at these people. Obviously, there's no point. I'm very, very keen to try and, I wasn't doing that tweet, I should say, to try and inflame a reaction. But I like the idea of trying to calm things down and have conversations. Because actually, going back to the Joubert quote, the argument isn't about winning, it's about progress. It was just an interesting thing. I don't normally ever do anything on social media which gets people that angry. And so I have many friends who've given up on social media because of that sort of thing. I'm doing stuff about hedgehogs. It's kind of fine. But this was just one of those moments again. Absolutely. That level of anger is so vigorous. And it's the evidence is very clear that the algorithms for the social media platforms are based around outrage, and outrage generates attention, and attention is capital, and that's where the money is. So if you are going to be putting out benign things about hedgehogs and trying to help hedgehogs, you're not going to get much attention. Whereas if you do something which inflames outrage, then the algorithms pick that up, and they know that that's where the attention is going to come, and that's where money comes in through advertising. And you end up being given a choice. Well, do I engage because I want to give my shout back, or do I remain silent? And towards the end of the book, I give this description. I stole it off Rory Stewart, one of our political commentators in the United Kingdom. And he described political discourse as previously being much more like a bell curve, like a normal distribution curve,
right,
where the body of opinion, the bulk of people's opinions tends to be within the bell curve, and you have outliers on either side, but there are fewer of them. And he, since 2014, with the sort of surge in use of social media, you've got this bell curve being turned inside out into an empty wine glass. And so you have this vacuum in the middle. And I know that space because you're in the middle and you say something moderate, both sides will shout at you.
For being moderate. I've been there. For being moderate.
Because you're not with one of them. You're actually, you're giving, you're seen to being given credence to the other side because you're not taking the extreme position, the polarized position, the binary position.
We're completely out of time, and we've only scratched the surface of this book. I'm serious. My guest tonight has been Hugh Warwick. He's an ecologist, environmental writer, with a particular fondness for hedgehogs. And we're talking about his new book. It's deep, but fun and interesting. Cull of the Wild, Killing in the Name of Conservation. Hugh, thank you so much for your time.
Mark, thank you. That's fascinating.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.